All right, this is an interview with Ewan Buchanan, who is the External Relations Officer for UNMOVIC.
Actually, my title is Public Information Officer, but...
Okay, Public Information Officer with UNMOVIC at the moment. And this is July 18th, 2001, and we're at UN headquarters in New York, and I'm Jean Krasnow. So actually, just to start with, could you just explain when you started working here at the UN and when you started working for UNSCOM, because you were with UNSCOM prior?
Yep, I joined UNSCOM in September 1995 and was with it to the end when it was then dissolved in December 1999. And since that time, I've been with UNMOVIC. Yeah.
Okay. And were you with the UN prior to coming to UNSCOM?
Nope. I was, like most of the people, provided by a supporting government. Okay. I had been previously working in the British Foreign Office, in fact, in the embassy in Washington, had quit that, had done a couple of other things. And then, in fact, in my case, the UNSCOM was looking to replace a guy called Tim Trevann, and they asked the British Foreign Office if they could find somebody, and I just happened... that a colleague who was working in the Foreign Office at the time said, by the way, we've been asked to provide somebody to UNSCOM, how would you like to take the job and we'll pay you for it? So although I did not technically belong to the Foreign Service at that point, I was kind of provided by them and paid for by them.
Okay, actually then, that leads me right into my first question, which is a perfect segue. I think it's important to clarify the financing of UNSCOM. And as you mentioned, your salary was actually covered by your government. Were any salaries actually, or any expenses paid by the UN itself through the, UN...
The original idea was to make UNSCOM funded by voluntary contributions, whether that be in actual cash, which we did get from a number of countries, certainly Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, we had money from the Brits, we had money from the Japanese, the Americans, or in addition to money, we were looking for physical help, whether it be with equipment. Mm-hmm. I mean, the French provided us with protective suits, gas masks mm-hmm. equivalent. The British provided computers, the Americans gave us laboratory equipment, the Germans provided us helicopter support. So we were looking for cash, equipment, and people.
Okay.
And all of those were financed by the governments that provided things. The only thing that was actually, paid out of UN funds were the kind of support staff. So the professional staff were provided by governments and paid by those governments, whereas the support staff, our accounts people, our travel clerks, our secretaries, they were on the UN payroll.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, that's a good clarification, because I wasn't absolutely...
But the only thing that we did get, though, I mean, the inspectors in the field and those of us working here in New York, we were provided with a per diem payment by the UN to cover the costs of accommodation, basically. So if you were an inspector going into Iraq, you would still be expected to be paid by the British Army or whoever it was who sent you, but you would get, depended on the exchange rates, but sort of $100 a day to cover local costs, such as the hotels where people stayed. Yeah, and that was a cost to the UN. Yeah.
That was out of the UN, which
yes.
was paid by member states' dues?
No, in fact, it was more complicated than that. I mean, money was originally transferred, Resolution 778, if I'm not mistaken, asked for funds to be transferred from the frozen Iraqi assets which governments held. The United States provided roughly $200 million. There was some ceiling set by the resolution that no one country could contribute more than half of an overall total of $400 million. The Americans provided $200 million, of which we got roughly $60 million. And we used that money to pay the electricity bills, the airfares of people traveling to Iraq, the costs of the building here, we have to pay rent, the salaries, all these sort of things. So, I mean, that money we were, first of all, financed out of frozen Iraqi assets transferred by governments, in this case, only the United States, to the UN.
Oh, okay.
That money then ran out, basically,
okay.
after about, I suppose it must have been 3 or 4 years. Then we lived on voluntary contributions, as in mainly cash money given to us by the, by and large, Gulf states, plus some smaller amounts from other governments.
Uh-huh. And then later on,
then Resolution 986, which was adopted in 95, but not actually implemented until 96. Mm-hmm. The resolution, I mean, there was a complicated formula, but it allocated monies to various UN operations. Mm-hmm. And UNSCOM received not 0.8% of the oil monies, which, you know, the UN was in charge of. And
that, so 0.8% of the oil for food monies.
Yeah. The figure was arrived at because the original 986 deal was $2 million of exports every 6 months. Mm-hmm. And our approximate cash operating costs were something of the order of $15-16 million every 6 months. So, I mean, that was how we came out with the 0.8%.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But what's changed over the years is that the council has adjusted the amount of oil that Iraq was allowed to sell, mm-hmm. but has not adjusted the figures as to who gets what.
Oh.
So, in fact, I mean, UNSCOM started to take in an awful lot more money than we were spending.
Because it was still a percentage,
yes.
not a fixed number.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, that's interesting.
But, I mean, fundraising was a problem in the early years. I mean, mm-hmm. the then executive chairman, I mean, he often complained that when he was told when he took the job he would just have to run the organization, but he, you know, spent a lot of his time actually trying to raise money.
I'm just trying to see. Oh, here's the microphone. I think I had it turned the wrong way. Right, in our interview with Akeas, he talks about the frustration mm-hmm. of having to raise the money. But you mentioned that you actually have had to pay rent for the office space. And now, when you joined...
Well, actually, maybe rent isn't the right word. There is some kind of system, you know, the common services of the building, whether it be the cleaners, the lights, the, you know, it's per head, it's something like 13% of your budget has to be paid to the UN for common services.
You know, like an overhead cost.
Yes, basically, yes.
Yes,
not
okay.
really rent. Actually, yeah.
Oh, that's okay. That's a good point. Oh, no, I forget where I was going to go after that, but I'll go on. There are just some technical questions, and actually mm-hmm. I think they sort of jump around a little bit, so I'm sorry. But the intelligence analysis unit was started fairly early within UNSCOM. But when was the concealment unit started?
Well, first of all, I think I should correct. The IAU was the information assessment unit.
Information assessment unit, yes.
intelligence always has kind of overtones, but so we always talk about information rather than intelligence. Intelligence almost implies some sort of illegitimate sort of gathering of information as opposed to information which we have the perfect right to gather, whether it be from Iraq's declarations or governments or whatever.
Right, right.
No, but the information assessment unit was set up fairly early on before I arrived, so I wouldn't know the exact date, but sort of 92 probably.
Yeah, I think so.
Concealment basically became an issue after the defection of Hussein Khan.
Mm-hmm.
When it was quite clear that the Iraqis had a sort of fairly good systematic organization or group of people who were involved in hiding stuff from us.
Mm-hmm.
And it was clear, I think, to the executive chairman at the time in, say, 95, that if we wanted to get any more out of Iraq, we really had to crack that concealment mechanism and really get to the heart of things as to what they were still concealing.
Mm-hmm.
So it was probably towards the end of 95, maybe early 96, as best I can remember.
Yeah. Okay, okay. And then Scott Ritter talked about something called CSIC?
CISI.
The
group had a variety of names throughout its life. I mean, at one point it was Concealment, Capable Sites and Concealment Units, CSCU.
Mm.
What did CISI stand for? Capable Sites. I'd really have to think. I can tell you that I can find out. But,
mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean, yeah.
So there. So the CISI, or what he's talking about, is a slightly different organization than the concealment unit.
Well, no, it was part of the same thing. I mean, it's difficult to explain. We had the three or four, depending how we look at it, specific weapons discipline, chemist, biological, missile, but whereas the capable sites and concealment, they were supposed to have an overall view of all the disciplines. I should maybe explain what capable sites were. This was an initiative actually started by the IAEA, our nuclear colleagues, where we wanted to start looking at sites which we previously had not inspected, which we believed were capable of either being used as production sites or hide sites, whatever else. And so we launched a number of inspections by going to new undeclared sites. Mm-hmm. And it happened to be that the same people who were looking after the concealment were in charge of selecting and running the inspections into these so-called capable sites. So it was capable sites and concealment units, CSCU. Yeah. And Sissy was... before Nikita asked.
Well, it seemed as though this is where we were getting confused, because we thought that the concealment unit, however it was titled, was set up shortly after the Kamal defection,
yeah.
when that became apparent that that was going on. But then Ritter talks about this Sissy unit being set up under Butler, which was then much later. So that was our point of confusion, that so maybe there was a sort of a new element of it being set up under Butler, where they were going, the idea basically, if I understand it correctly, was to go to sites which they thought were housing documents that related to the concealment mechanism, but also to challenge the Iraqis so that they might actually deny them access, and then UNSCOM.
Well, I think we realized sort of maybe late 95, early 96, as best I can recall, about this concealment mechanism. And I mean, I think it became clear that we realized that the people who were involved in concealing the stuff from us were by and large the security services, the intelligence people, the kind of special defense, I mean, the so-called Special Republican Guard, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And so it became clear that we would be sort of, in essence, I mean, these were the same organizations that controlled the security of the state, the security of the president, etc., that we were going to come up against a kind of crunch point by inspecting these sites.
Mm-hmm.
But that certainly started before Butler joined. I mean, this was certainly, mm-hmm. I think, the first of those sort of inspections dealing with kind of concealment was UNSCOM 143, which I believe took place in possibly March or June of 96. Mm-hmm. And there were three initial inspections, 143, 150, and 155, where we were looking specifically for sites where we believed large amounts of documentation were hidden by those various security organs of the government.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the first ones involved what we believed to have been a large stash of documents at what turned out, or what the Iraqis claimed to be, the Ministry of Irrigation. I think that was in June of 96. Yeah. Oh. So that was before Butler was here.
Right, yeah.
So, I mean, the names may have changed over the years, or there may have been different groupings, but the kind of concealment work was basically started in late 95, early 96.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Well, then that clarifies that point then. Yeah.
But it may not have been, it may not have been sort of formalized. I mean, Sissy, I think, was probably, I mean, a later designation. We also had people in most of the concealment work was run out of here in New York, where the analysts were, whereas later on with the Sissy element, we actually had people in Baghdad doing some of the activity. And that would have taken place probably in the Butler period rather than in KS.
Oh, okay, maybe that was the difference then, that there was a Sissy team in Baghdad.
Yeah.
Okay.
Where they were largely responsible for running the so-called capable sites, these inspections of new facilities or new locations which we'd not inspected in the past, which we wanted to check out to see what their capabilities were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is this, industrial complex, is it capable of production, or is it capable of being used as a hide site? So it was to sort of try and map out more of Iraq in terms of what could be going on.
Okay.
And that was done. So the Sissies were, some of them were in Baghdad. Yeah. So this is going to end up being more confused than helping you.
No, that's actually, in fact, that's a very important clarification, because we were getting confused between these things, and now I think I understand it. Okay. Now, getting back a little bit to the UN and the UN staff here in the building, in the whole headquarters, how much cooperation was there initially, or was there throughout, with the UN itself and the legal office, John Scott and legal office, or the office of the Secretary General? Was there a sense of cooperation?
Well, we were a rather unusual organization in that we were a so-called subsidiary organ of the Security Council. And so therefore our political masters were the Security Council rather than the Secretary General. So we were not a part of the kind of regular secretariat. I mean, the regular secretariat consists of departments such as peacekeeping, political affairs, the Department for Disarmament Affairs. We were not part of that structure. We were a kind of, let's say, a separate unit with a different reporting structure. We reported straight to the Security Council, not to the Secretary General. So we were, to a certain extent, sort of independent almost of the rest of the House.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, I mean, we shared common services, yes. We would use the services of the legal affairs, but we had our own lawyers. And there are not many other parts of the UN system that would have a lawyer in-house, but it was something we wanted to have. And, you know, we had a certain, I suppose, independence that we, because of the way we were established and the ability to ask governments to provide people, we could sort of, you know, build up our own in-house capabilities by having lawyers or whatever else, or analysts, or, for example, photo interpreters.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are not sort of things we could find within the UN system, so we would ask government, say, please provide us with a photo interpreter for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so we had our own in-house capabilities. Yes, we would rely on the rest of the UN for a lot of sort of administrative and sort of budgetary support, people who, for example, doing travel organisation, or, you know, organising visas. Yes, we used all that, I mean, on a day-to-day basis with the UN. But we were, by and large, kind of left to our, you know, I don't mind the expression, but left to our own devices.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the Secretary General and his office had a watching brief over us, and, you know, I mean, the various executive chairmen, I mean, maintained reasonably good contact with the Secretary General's office and would meet, well, I suppose, every 3 months or more, depending on what was going on, so that the Secretary General's office were informed.
Because, you know, mm-hmm,
obviously,
mm-hmm,
we are still part of the same organisation, and we're not that sort of remote.
Yeah. Was there any resentment by the UN staff outside of UNSCOM towards the sort of special privileges that UNSCOM had?
Having been on the inside, I'm not sure how accurate I can portray this. We certainly believed, whether it was there or not is another matter, but we certainly believed we were looked at with a certain sense, perhaps even of envy, by other parts of the system, or a certain amount of suspicion, because we were independent. We didn't have to, for example, follow regular UN recruitment procedures. We just asked people to come and they came.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have to go through the horrendous system of UN procurement, which takes 6 months to get a photocopier or whatever. We would simply ask the government, please give us some computers, and they would roll up the next day. So, I mean, I think there was some resentment to the sort of freewheeling system that we were able to operate. Yeah, and I know, I mean, there are frustrations in any big bureaucracy, and we were able to avoid some of them. So I think there was a kind of feeling of, oh, there they go again, these UNSCOM people, they can, you know, doing what they like. And perhaps we didn't represent the UN family as much as other organisations. We were drawn from governments which were interested in doing this. I mean, we did have, I suppose it might even be termed a bias towards kind of Western Anglo-Saxon. But it was because those governments had the people, had the knowledge, had the experience, the background, and the willingness to support the operation. There were plenty of governments who we asked to provide people, and they simply said no, they couldn't spare them, they couldn't afford it, or they didn't have them.
Did the debate over sanctions have any impact on how people in the UN outside UNSCOM viewed UNSCOM?
Again, I'm not the best person to ask about the outside view of us, so it's only a kind of perception on my part. But yes, I mean, there was a feeling that, you know, UNSCOM was in some way responsible for the sanctions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, whereas certainly the two executive chairmen tried to sort of turn around the other way and sort of say, no, we were the instrument for the lifting of sanctions. And, you know, I mean, we were the vehicle for that. If Iraq cooperated with us, we were the ones who were going to turn the key, basically, and unlock the gates. But nevertheless, I mean, there was certainly a view in the media and elsewhere in the general public that UNSCOM was the ones who were keeping the sanctions on, which is, I don't believe personally to be true. But
mm-hmm.
And in fact, I mean, on a strict reading of the resolutions and of the origins of it all, that UNSCOM's work was actually only linked to the oil embargo. I mean, the actual prohibition on exports, on buying anything from Iraq, rather than the general sanctions on exports to Iraq.
But now UNSCOM had, because we're talking about UNSCOM, which is in the past, an import-export unit. Which what was the tasks of that unit?
In fact, just breaking this, the woman who came in, that's Rachel Davies, who's in charge of the export import and the IAU and everything else. That's Rachel. Yeah.
Oh,
I'm sure you heard her name.
Yes, I've heard her name, but I never met her before. Okay.
Maybe you should do her, actually, because she's been around since 92 or 93, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Anyway, no, yeah, I mean, it was always perceived that as part of the kind of, that monitoring would have sort of two things. There would be an internal element in Iraq by having inspections going around checking on dual-use equipment to make sure it was being used for legitimate purposes.
Mm-hmm.
But it was always envisaged early on in 91 that there would be an extra component which would help our monitoring of Iraq's capabilities by knowing what was going into the country.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, in the early days, after sort of the sanctions were imposed, there was virtually no trade with Iraq. Iraq was not exporting oil. And in essence, not much was really going in other than sort of food and medicines and a few other humanitarian things.
Mm-hmm.
And so the export-import mechanism was not actually brought into being until 1996. And I need to check, the Resolution 1051 is the one which brought it into being. And this started up a new notification system, and I do stress it was a notification system, not a kind of licensing or permission scheme.
Mm-hmm.
It was to allow us to better have a handle on what was actually going into Iraq and where it was being used.
Okay.
Governments and Iraq, I mean the supplier governments and the receiving government Iraq, had to notify us of transfers of dual-use goods. And we had lists which, you know, so a government would know that if, for example, they were exporting laboratory equipment, which may have a perfectly legitimate use in a public health laboratory in Iraq, the government concern would notify us that we have done a deal with the Baghdad Central Public Health Laboratory, we are supplying them with ABC equipment, which we would then be able to go and inspect in Iraq and actually determine, yes, indeed, this shipment of glassware or this laboratory equipment has arrived, it is as stated to have been. And yes, we now know it's being used for perfectly legitimate purposes in Iraq. And the monitoring teams, we had a specific export-import monitoring team who would go out and check the details of the notifications that we had received from the government and from Iraq, that they were correct and the stuff was there and being used properly.
Mm-hmm.
And as necessary, I mean, we had an elaborate system tagging equipment by putting sort of either seals or barcodes so we could keep a track on this stuff.
Oh.
And so if a particular facility had a piece of tagged equipment, they would have to report on its whereabouts, or if they sold it or moved it, they'd have to tell us.
Okay.
So the export-import was really to give us a better handle on stuff going into Iraq so that we had an idea of what Iraq's capabilities were.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Is that still in place? I mean, I'm not asking you about UNMOVIC particularly.
Yes, no, I mean, the export-import, we established what was known as the joint unit because we have cooperation, obviously, with our nuclear colleagues in Vienna at the IAEA. For most of our UNSCOM period, we, in fact, had an IAEA person seconded to us from Vienna working with us here in New York. That fell away, I only can't remember, probably about 2 years ago. That the unit still exists, and we are still receiving, as UNMOVIC, notifications from governments of their export of equipment to Iraq.
Okay.
We are not receiving anything from the government of Iraq. The last thing they sent us would have been December 98. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, they are still, in theory, under an obligation to notify us.
Okay.
And so,
the joint unit part of that title is joint between IAEA and UNSCOM.
Yes, yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay, that's...
Not Iraq, no.
Right,
yeah.
I mean, that was the title. Okay, that's very helpful. Now, it's been pointed out that Achaeus and Butler had different working styles. From your point of view within, inside, you know, what was your perception of the differences between the two executive chairmen?
Can I plead the fifth?
You can if you want to. let me ask you a more specific question on that regard.
They're very different characters,
yeah.
Obviously,
mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed working for both of them. They're very different styles.
Well, let me ask you a more specific question, which will be easier to answer, I think. In the research that we've been doing, we really have come to the conclusion that the independence of Anscombe was really the key factor in maintaining the pressure and leverage on Iraq. And I, perhaps you could comment on how Achaeus and then Butler exercised or maintained the independence of Anscombe.
Independence from?
Independence from governments, from influence on other parties within the UN, from the general members, like the General Assembly, the Office of the Secretary General, any way in which Iraq could succeed in going around Anscombe, just to keep the executive chairman the authority for dealing with Iraq.
Yes, I mean, I think in the early years, the council was really quite happy almost to say to Achaeus, it's your baby, you go away and deal with it, and don't come running to us basically with your problems, you fix it.
Yeah? Mm-hmm.
I mean, we'll give you all the rights, which they did. I mean, the council gave Anscombe tremendous rights. You go away and sort it out. And it was amusing, not amusing isn't the right word, but noticeable that whenever we would go to the Security Council to sort of bring up a problem we were having with the Iraqis, there would be a general, oh no, not you lot again coming here to complain about yet another transgression by the Iraqis. Why can't you just, you know, sort it out with them? Why do you need to come whining to us? So, I mean, there was to a certain extent a kind of hands-off approach, particularly in the early years, from both the Council and to a certain extent the Secretary General's office. But I think that changed later on. As perhaps, you know, I mean, I think the whole Anscombe project, if that's the right word for it, I mean, it was never intended to be a 10-year experience. It was all supposed to be over in 6 months. The Iraq would give up the weapons and they would get back in the international community. And I think, I mean, the whole politics of the thing changed. It was originally about weapons and non-proliferation. Then it started to become, you know, other aspects crept up, whether it be the humanitarian situation, the general political situation in the Middle East, what was perceived perhaps as bias, why this was going on in Iraq, why was the UN not tackling other problems in the region, whether it be Israel or peace process, or you had other proliferation things going on, India and Pakistan. So, I mean, many more other factors, I think, came into play, which I think then caused the Council, the Secretary General's office and others to take a much closer interest.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean, governments were interested from day one. I mean, we could never have done anything without involvement or the help of governments. So, I mean, it was a delicate balance of obviously trying to get the best from governments, but then keeping them at bay in terms of, yes, we'll take your expertise, yes, we'll take your information, but thank you very much, we'll do without your advice. I mean, it's a very difficult balancing act for both executive chairmen to have done.
Mm-hmm.
To have gotten everything out of the governments, but then to keep them at arm's length when it came to actually deciding policies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all of the Security Council members, I mean, they had their views and they would come round and make them known.
Mm-hmm.
And the executive chairman would have to decide or weigh up, you know, how much they would take this into account.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
both of them realised, you know, we were not working in a vacuum, that, I mean, the council members are powerful players. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Were there any differences on how either one managed that?
Yeah, I mean, I joined in 95, by which time things, I mean, I had the impression, and it's only an impression, that prior to that point, Achaeus had been by and large left alone by the Security Council. I mean, there had been a stormy initial period,
mm-hmm.
then a sort of relatively tranquil 92, 93, 94, where we were getting on with the obvious, as people say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were destroying the things that Iraq had declared, or we were doing the chemical disruption group, and things like that were going on. But when that was all done, then we came to the new sort of crunch time, what next? And then all these other factors, the politics, you know, the price of oil, the humanitarian, all these things. So I think there was less pressure on Achaeus probably than there was on Butler.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean, not to say that it didn't exist. I mean, certainly, I mean, both of them had to maintain fairly close relations with all the council members. and both, you know, would visit certainly as, you know, at least annually most of the P5. The Chinese actually didn't really start to get interested in UNSCOM until probably about 97. I mean, I know that KS had wanted to go to Beijing or wanted to involve the Chinese, but there had always been a sort of a distance between us. It was only really when Buckler came on board that China, for example, started to offer us experts, mm-hmm. Something which they'd never done before. And China became a much more of a player than it had been before. So, I mean, there were things that, in the wider political environment, I think, which caused, I suspect, more pressure to be put on Buckler. Yeah.
Now, you know, I told you that I had just seen this documentary film that Scott Ritter had been involved in, and which brought up the whole relationship of Buckler with the Americans, and he proposes that you know, that Buckler felt much more that he had to accommodate the Americans ultimately than Achaeus had done originally. Was that ever felt by other people here?
Again, I don't have the full history, but I suspect, I mean, we were closer to the Americans during the Buckler time than Achaeus, yeah. Although not to say that there wasn't a close relationship beforehand.
And then the other thing that I've been trying to wrestle with is...
Can I ask you, have you interviewed Buckler?
We have requested interviews with Buckler, and in
general... You don't type up this kind of stuff, do you?
Pardon?
Do you type up this kind of chat?
Oh, well, it would.
Okay.
Do you want me to turn it off?
No, I'm just curious to know from my own sort of...
No, we've asked him, and he has generally agreed, but then he has never really made the appointment. We keep calling to make the appointment, and there's some problem always. So we're going to try again, though. We really would, you know, I think it's fair to ask him these questions. But in terms of, you know, the ending of UNSCOM, you know, as you had mentioned, after December 1998, UNSCOM was never able to go back in to Iraq. And it was punctuated by Desert Fox, which was the bombing that took place, I believe, on December 16th of 1998. So, in a certain sense, the question that I have is, what came first, the chicken or the egg? I mean, did the bombing basically end UNSCOM, or did UNSCOM basically end, and because of the denials of Iraq that seemed absolutely permanent at that point, that the bombing took place as a kind of, you know, punishment for what was deemed to be the end?
Well, I'm trying to think back to the kind of summer of 1998. I mean, the Iraqis sort of, it is said that the Iraqis were particularly frustrated by the fact the Security Council took virtually no recognition, or at least from their point of view, took no recognition of the progress that had been made in the nuclear area in particular. It is said that they were greatly frustrated that while everybody acknowledged there had been great progress, nothing happened. Iraq wasn't, quote, rewarded, unquote, or there was no kind of... and so it seems that they took from that the idea, or gained the impression that no matter what they did, they were never going to get out of this, the situation they were in, and then decided, in essence, to think, well, why on earth should we cooperate with this lot, UNSCOM? Look where our cooperation landed us with the IAEA. I mean, they've basically said they have a full understanding of the program. There's only a few question marks left, and nothing has changed. You know, we haven't gotten anything out of this. Mm-hmm. So why the hell should we cooperate with UNSCOM? Mm-hmm. And so from then onwards, the Iraqis basically, you know, took a number of measures, such as throwing out the Americans. Then they refused to do any more of the disarmament work with us. They refused to give us documents. They eventually, ultimately, said no more monitoring. Even, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. so there were various things where they upped the stakes and just simply said no more, no more.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I mean, something was going to come to a head. mean, did the bombing kill Anscombe or was it dead anyway? I really don't, you know, I mean, we had been unable to do any substantive disarmament work. And that meant, I mean, even the Iraqis, you know, refusing to speak to us almost since mm-hmm. August of that year.
Okay. Okay. So it was...
Although, I mean, it has been said publicly, including by President Clinton, that the bombing was designed to reintroduce the inspectors, to get, you know, the system back going again.
Yeah. Because, in fact, military action in the past had reinstated Anscombe.
By and large, yeah, I mean, things would get to a head, and the council, or the threat of military action, not necessarily actual... you know, an actual use of force itself, but the possible threat of it usually caused the Iraqis to back down or change their mind or find some compromise or way that, you know, whatever the situation could be resolved and we could move on. So, I remember at the time, I think both Clinton and Sandy Berger did sort of say, you know, that the action they were taking was to restore the integrity of the inspection process.
Mm-hmm. Well, there had been an example early on in the KS's tenure where the airplanes coming from Bahrain were not allowed to come directly to Baghdad.
Yeah.
And there was all kinds of discussion over several days. There's a whole series of letters and dates that are in the Blue Book on Iraq situation where they continued to refuse. And KS felt it was very important for that plane to be able to fly directly from Bahrain to Baghdad. And so there was bombing that took place. And immediately following the bombing, the Iraqis got in contact with Anscombe and said, okay, your plane can fly exactly wherever it wants to. So there had been a precedent for military action to get a result.
Yeah.
So perhaps the Americans did feel that was...
And, I mean, in November of 98, I mean, when there had been the sort of almost bombing, if that's the right word, both Clinton and Blair had publicly said that there would be no warning next time, that if Iraq didn't cooperate, both of them publicly came out and said that. So, I mean, Iraq was on notice almost that if they didn't cooperate with us, there would be further military action. And I believe Clinton had said at the time that there would be no warning.
Right.
There would not be discussions in the Security Council, there would not be sort of consultations, it would just be a case of if Iraq stepped out of line, they would be hit, basically.
Yeah. So from Anscombe's point of view, sitting here at headquarters, what was Anscombe's reaction to the bombing?
Well, I suspect we all had our own individual private reactions. There was no, I mean, Anscombe as a body or as an entity had no reaction. I mean, what you individual member states do, is their business in essence. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And obviously, we have our own individual feelings.
So. Yeah. Did you hope that it would open the doors to Iraq again, or did you think that maybe it was not going to happen?
On a personal basis, I probably at the time I think sort of thought that the bombing would happen and then we would go back. Yes, mm-hmm. It probably took me on a personal level maybe 3 or 4 months to sort of realize that that we wouldn't go back to what had been going on before. And in fact, it wasn't really long after the bombing took place of Desert Fox that there were already were discussions in the Security Council, you know, about the need for some new mechanism, some new approach. And in fact, I need to check, but only days after the bombing had taken place, I mean, some of the Security Council members, I think the French, started talking about, the need for something new.
Okay. All right, well, that helps to understand that. Now, I wanted to ask you, and this may be where you may have to refer me to somebody else, but I've been going over the report that was dated, I believe, January 25th, 1999, which was the big, thick report.
Which we nicknamed the Compendium. Yeah.
The Compendium.
Yeah.
Basically pulling together an assessment or an accounting of, what had been destroyed, what was unaccounted for. And you had started to say something on the phone when I talked to you about how that report had come about. Perhaps you could just give me a little background on that.
Yes, as best I can remember, that's probably... when the Secretary General went to Iraq in February 98, from press accounts and what I've heard, on the grapevine, the Iraqis complained that they hadn't really been given a fair opportunity to kind of address a whole host of grievances about the UN, not just about UNSCOM, but about everything, basically. Mm-hmm. And that they believed they hadn't had a sort of proper hearing about their side of things. They weren't allowed to address the council, or they were ignored, or their views were never taken into account. And I think this struck a note with the Secretary General, and he came up with the idea of a so-called comprehensive review. And this was, as first envisaged by some of the players, was an opportunity for Iraq to basically take its grievances to the council and have some of those things addressed publicly, perhaps. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there were a number of exchanges. I think the Secretary General circulated a paper proposing an outline of what the comprehensive review would or could, in his view, try to address.
Okay.
There was then as part of that, he talked about a review of where we were with the kind of status of disarmament and verification of the disarmament. And one of the ideas was that we, as UNSCOM, would produce, an assessment, basically, of where matters rested. The ideas were batted back and forward. We've been doing assessments all the way along, but we thought, right, well, here's a chance for us to sort of have our say. Mm-hmm. And so work was started on producing papers. Although nothing had been agreed at that point, work started on putting together assessments by the various disciplines, the chemists, the biology, the missile people, mm-hmm. to come up with an assessment. In the end, the conditions for the comprehensive review were somewhat changed, and I think there was a letter from the President of the Council outlining the arrangements for a comprehensive review, and that all got folded into the whole business in the middle of November 98.
Okay.
And in essence, what was going to happen was that the report, which was ultimately asked of us on Iraq's cooperation between the middle of November and the middle of December, and if we reported positively on that, then there was going to be the comprehensive review. And we need to go back and look at the covering letter which the Secretary General sent to the Security Council on the evening of the 15th of December, transmitting the reports from Butler and from the IAEA on Iraq's cooperation. And in that, I think the Secretary General offers three options. That the Council, although Iraq had not necessarily provided the level of cooperation the Council had been seeking, the comprehensive review should nevertheless go ahead, or it should be postponed was another option, or mm-hmm. abandoned, I think, was the third option.
Okay.
So, and so in any case, the comprehensive review never happened. And so we had, since we'd put quite a bit of work into this document, or into what we perceived might be required from us for the comprehensive review, it was decided that this thing shouldn't just go back on the shelf. Mm-hmm. it was a... an assessment which we were had been preparing for public release, so why not do it? So mm-hmm. Richard Butler decided to send it to the Security Council, mm-hmm. and in fact at the time there were certain members of the Security Council who simply said that this report had not in fact been asked for by the Council, so why should it be circulated? So in actual fact, if you look closely at the document itself, you'll notice that the covering letter circulating the report comes not from actually from UNSCOM, but from two council members. If I'm correct, it was Slovenia and the Netherlands who said, in the interest of transparency and given the interest not only to the Security Council but to all UN member states in this issue, perhaps the UNSCOM assessment should be circulated as a public document to the Security Council, and that's what happened.
Oh, okay. That's really interesting. Now you look more carefully at the details and the understanding behind why.
Why is it a letter from these two delegations?
Why is it a letter? Okay, that's fascinating. Well, in looking over the report...
If you don't type this, you know who it was who tried to block it. Yeah, the Russians. You can't have that type, please.
No, okay. No. We have actually a very interesting interview with Ambassador Lavrov.
I'm sure you have.
yeah. From his point of view. No. So we in going
not
over
doing that actually.
Going you well, at some point it will be available. In going through the report, what I wanted to do was to try to come up with a summary of the achievements of UNSCOM. And I still really want to do that, because I think that that's an important part of a book that we produce, because we have a scholarly book, and we're now doing it a couple of years after the end of UNSCOM, so it's possible to look at the whole time. But in the numbers that came together, there just were a few things that I was trying to understand, and one of the areas is VX, the chemical VX, the chemical agent VX. So there's a few things that I just wanted to ask you from my own understanding, and then in sort of accounting for it, maybe I need to talk to somebody else, but whatever, you know, from your point of view. Now, my understanding in reading about chemical weapons is that the importance of VX is that it is the most toxic of the agents. Is that a fair characterization?
As a non-technical expert, that is my understanding. It also has, I'm not sure how to, the right word to use, but one of its attributes is that it's persistent. I mean, a lot of chemical weapons agents, when you disperse them or fire them or release them, whatever, they degrade or they lose their potency, whereas VX, one of its characteristics, in addition to being very toxic, is its persistency. So if you were to detonate a shell in this room, for example, it would hang around much better than other agents. So it has, not only is it highly toxic, but it's also persistent, which makes it, that you can improve your kill rate, if that's the right expression.
Okay. Yeah. So...